Hello, and welcome to recording number 14 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today we're starting on page 103, paragraph 5. Completing repairs and finishing the celebration took another week. The six barges at Cavern Cliff Cove were joined by several others in the interim, and most of the original ones left within a few days. As surely as if directed by the fates, the first new barge to arrive bore none other than Adaz, his friend from his earlier days with the Renee. She was now mature and more lovely than Gord's remembrance of her. She was delighted to see him, too, at first. "Gord, you've grown so big and strong and handsome," Adaz cried when they first met. She ran her hand over his muscular arm. Gord flushed at that and murmured vaguely about having had to do much growing up. "And you, Adaz, you are as beautiful as ever," he finished somewhat lamely. "Thank you, Gord. I know that you mean it, too. Why else would you have come all the way from Greyhawk just to find me?" They talked a bit, casually, as Adaz linked her arm in his and steered him toward the community encampment. It was all downhill, in a manner of speaking, after that. When she saw Estrella and learned of the fight with Zoltan, she shunned Gord entirely. That made him sad and furious at the same time. "Don't worry," Yano reassured him. "As soon as you become a chief man in the tribe, and you have your own barge, then you can have as many women as you can keep." Worst of all, Estrella was a nag and a bitch. She was pretty, but the constant whining tone in her voice drove Gord mad. At every opportunity, she was after him to get her presents. Jewelry, clothing, any number of things she must have. All of it, she assured him, to enhance Gord's status, of course. When she wasn't on that tack, Estrella was urging him to get rid of Zoltan, challenge Miklos for lordship of the barge, take her to some rich town, and so on, and so on, and so on. If she caught him looking at Adaz, or any of the other young girls, or even thought he might wish to look, she would verbally abuse him, or physically attack him, scratching, biting, hitting, and kicking him, until he had to subdue her. Beat her more frequently, Miklos advised sagely. Gord was certain that Zoltan was somewhere nearby laughing. Every time he looked up from a scene with Estrella, he saw the fellow's back as he walked away. Zoltan's shoulders were either shrugging or shaking with mirth, and Gord knew there was no reason for him to shrug. In desperation, he sought out his archenemy one day when Estrella was busy elsewhere. "You won, Zoltan," said Gord. "Oh, well, I know that, Gord. I don't wish to be your enemy, Zoltan. Let us put this behind us and be friends." Zoltan did shrug then. "That you did me two great favors is true. You spared my life when it was yours for the taking, and you made it worth living by ridding me of Estrella. I would kiss you if I could, but our custom dictates I must now be your foe. However, you need never worry that I shall again try to kill you, friend Gord, because if I did, that bitch would be mine again." His darkly tanned face split into a huge laugh at that, head thrown back, white teeth showing. "You're a funny bastard, aren't you, Zoltan?" That only made him laugh harder. Gord walked away while Zoltan fell over on the ground, holding his sides, tears streaming down the sides of his face, lost in helpless gales of mirth. So much for that idea. Yano eventually came up with another suggestion, one that appealed more to Gord than his friend's first idea had. If Gord caught his woman in a compromising position with another of the tribe, he could either demand a duel with the fellow, or else he can insist that the violator take the woman and pay him silver in compensation. How in the devil Gord could manage to find anyone foolish enough to want to have anything to do with the shrewish Estrella was his problem. But there was the solution. All right, well, this goes more to the description of the Rene culture, and a little bit with Gord, and again his naivete, and being outsmarted by Zoltan. So, you know, we have here that Gord, even though he's skilled and he's got a good deal of experience in thievery, he wasn't actually all that skilled in the knife fight with Zoltan, in the sense that even though he won, he felt that he was in danger. And now he realizes that Zoltan has gotten rid of Estrella, who he no longer wanted. And within the culture of the Rene, it was one of the ways to escape, a dangerous way, to escape from a marriage or a mating. We're also told that the Rene are not monogamous, that as soon as Gord has a barge of his own, he can have more than one wife or more than one mate. And, you know, it adds something to the story and the campaign ideas in the background of what the Rene culture is like. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 105 and paragraph 2. Again, fate stepped in and took a hand. Three barges filled with a clan who came only infrequently to this spot arrived the next morning. Wonder of wonders, they contained quite a few handsome young bucks who had never met Estrella, nor heard of her evidently, for they cautiously but frequently shot her concupiscent looks. Gord was careful not to let on that he was noticing. Whatever he did not wish to have a fight yet another duel. He did not wish to have to fight yet another duel over her. He did not want to appear totally unconcerned, so he made a point of glaring at her vigilantly from time to time when she was not, at the moment, involved in flirtation. Estrella, in turn, smiled and winked back at several of the new young men any time she thought Gord was unaware of her. Great. Well, it just recently mentioned that this is springtime, the weather's warming, and this cove, although it's part of their winter place to lie out the winter, is now getting barges coming and going. So the barges that had been there, most of them have left, and all these new barges have come in. Gord runs again into Adaz, and now we have this idea that there are enough of these people in the barges, there are enough Rene, so that we don't have these young bargemen, these young Rene, who've met Estrella yet. And that seems to be a fairly interesting bit of information here. So you could say that the Rene, they must have a large enough population. Now, Estrella seems fairly young, so she may have been too young to be noticed earlier on. And that could explain why this Rene culture, that these men may not have had any notice of her when they were younger or when she was younger. Because it does seem kind of unlikely that since they are a very clannish group, in the sense that at the city of Greyhawk, their barges are all tied up in one section, it would seem like the Rene, even if they're from different families, do socialize with each other. They are coming to this cove where they winter, and it is a little strange to me that they wouldn't have already heard of Estrella, but I can think of a few reasons why they wouldn't have. They would, I believe, have to have a large enough population as well so that it wouldn't be, they wouldn't be in each other's pockets, so to say, that they wouldn't know everybody from every family. And that that gives you some idea then of what Gygax is thinking of the size of the Rene population and how far they may travel up and down the rivers, around the near Dev, on the Selatan, and that you may be able to encounter them on most of the waterways up and down the coast, or the waterways and the larger rivers throughout the Flaness. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 105, paragraph 3. That night, as the assembled family sat around the evening fires, singing and dancing as usual, Gord pretended to drink much wine. As he grew more boisterous, and seemingly in his cups, Estrella encouraged him to drink more and have fun. After an appropriate interval, Gord got up, swaying in his best drunken imitation, and stumbled and staggered off to the bushes to sleep. Sounds of crashing, followed by loud snores, gave Estrella all the incentive she needed. She quickly moved to where she could talk with the newcomers, especially the handsome young ones. Gord got up from his berth in the bushes and moved silently to the edge of the clearing, from where he could observe everything. After a short time, one of the newcomers strolled off into the foliage. Minutes later, Estrella, trying to move inconspicuously, left the group and took the same path. That was all Gord needed to see. He made his reappearance, went straight to where Miklos and Yano were seated, and whispered something to both of them. They rose and went off with Gord in the same direction Estrella had taken. After creeping carefully through the underbrush, I apologize, I do have difficulty turning these pages. After creeping carefully through the underbrush for a couple of minutes, the three of them caught Estrella and her lover in the act. Gord was outraged. He shouted and stormed. Estrella let out a scream, then began to weep and wail. Young Rene was pale in the moonlight, for he had heard that Gord was a renowned fighter, and he undoubtedly thought that he would soon demand a duel to the death over the violation of the beautiful Estrella. The young fellow's family gathered quickly, and his lord conversed softly with Miklos, talking about the time and place for the fight. "This is too much," cried Gord, putting an end to all the talk about fighting. "Never will I cast eyes upon you again, woman," spat Estrella. Then he turned abruptly to the fellow and added in an almost offhand note, "Well, where is my silver?" Well, here we have, again, one of the themes that runs through this book so far is Gord tends to use disguise and subterfuge and cons. And, I mean, it goes with the idea of the thief campaign, but it is in this first, first 11 chapters so far, very much the theme behind so much that has been happening is that there is a constant idea of this business of disguising intention, physical disguise, and that the idea of being able to see through these. And here we have Gord coming out with the idea he does not want to kill Estrella. So that shows a bit of a change from even his upbringing, which seems to put the life, the value of life fairly low. And yet Gord doesn't seem to have that. He balked at the idea of killing Estrella and just paying a fine. And yet here he is again outwitting the problems that he's having with Estrella. He does not want her. And now he's figured out a way of getting rid of her. And actually, once again, coming out ahead monetarily. So, we have what could be, for a DM, if you're running a Rene campaign, all of this goes to a good idea of how the culture is described to work.
Now, yeah, I mean, who would want Estrella? I mean, the way she's acting.
I know. And what it does come down to is it's not somebody like Zoltan who's more experienced. He regrets having won Estrella. It is somebody young and handsome. So with these, it could be somebody who's even, you know, with the way that they're doing things, this could be somebody who's just a teenager, 15 or 16, because they certainly have a very young, you know, there's really no teenage years. It's simply you probably just go from physically small childhood at this type of class level to suddenly being an adult.
Right.
And I would think that it would take somebody even more inexperienced than Gord to really just see that Estrella is beautiful and that's all that's necessary. We have again here too, and like I said, I mean, you do have to look and see that this is a lot, very out of place with modern viewpoints, but it's also supposed to be a different culture. And I think it's, you know, there was a recent review of this book and they were really shocked. And I don't know how true that was or just somebody trying to show how, you know, modern consciousness they had. But I mean, it is supposed to be a different culture so that it's not supposed to be something that would be a modern culture, a modern American, European culture. It's supposed to represent the way that these fantasy medieval people were operating. And earlier on, it was described that while the younger women are, you know, they're not as valued in a sense or not as respected, the older women are like the ones who are in charge of things. You know, it hasn't shown up yet, but in the earlier example, it would be, you know, the older group of women who would be in charge of, like, over Miklos and the others. And you don't hear how they're treated, or they're not mentioned at this point.
Yeah, we're not sure, though. But when Gord comes to on the lake after the encounter with the sea monster, he's being tended to by a woman. But you don't know if there's anything beyond just the basics that are handled there. But, I mean, I think that might be a little bit significant.
I do, too, because, I mean, it has been mentioned that they're acting in the capacity of both magic user in the form of a witch, divination, sages, fortune teller, but also that they're kind of like you know, a shaman or a clerical, like a high priestess kind of thing. So I would imagine that since we're dealing with the game system, that they would have minor healing spells, but it isn't mentioned. And it is interesting how little that magic is brought up. I think we have two mentions of magical light. We have a light stone that's mentioned that I forgot to cover back chapters ago when Gord throws it through the window of the one professor and reveals him in a compromising position. And I mean, that's an interesting thing that he would cast a light stone just for a trick, because that should be a fairly, you know, reasonably, you know, expensive item compared to how, you know, the value of money and coinage. And here again, we have at the end of this section, of this paragraph, we have that Gord is demanding his silver. And I just think that silver has to be markedly less valuable than golden electrum. It's just seems that, you know, the costs here compared to, you know, like the cost just seems like a dramatic rise for the Rene to be capable of paying these fines in silver, compared to how the poor people in the city of Greyhawk, where you'd think the expenses would be higher, you know, a big city, big prices. You think that there'd be, you know, the coinage would be worth less by the type of metal it is in the city of Greyhawk. And here, silver does not seem to be all that valuable. I mean, it's valuable enough, but just not ridiculously like gold is, and even electrum. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page number 106, and it is paragraph 5, right after the break, the text. A couple of days later, richer by 25 nobles and the lack of a woman, Gord was aboard Miklos's barge, which was heading along the coast of near Div with two other barges. They were bound for Lukesh, then Radagast City, whatever lay beyond. Gord was finally going to see something more of the world besides water. It was a relief to make their first port, Lukesh, without having to face anything on the trip more terrible than a pair of playful giant otters who swam near to see them. Since the animals were no threat to them, the barge folks simply ignored the otters and sailed on. There was little to do but loaf and fish until they arrived at the southeastern end of Near Dev and put into port. Lukesh was a small city compared to Greyhawk, even though it was the largest in the Duchy of Ernst and the capital of the place. Break. All right, well, we get a little bit more on the coinage here. Gord is paid off by 25 nobles, and that seems to be, you know, that's actually more than I believe that was just going to be 12 nobles for Gord before to avoid the fight that he couldn't avoid over Estrella with Zoltan. So I'm not sure exactly why the variance, but it's interesting to see that it's probably something. The cost of doing things among the Rene, even in these ritualistic things, they may be a deal with haggling more than simply just this is always what it costs. And then we have a little more information about the barges hugging the coast of the Near Dev. And they're going in a little group with two other barges, which sounds much safer than traveling alone in these waters. And then we hear where they're stopping in, Lukesh and Radagast City. We hear a little bit about Lukesh being a small city compared to Greyhawk, but the capital of the Duchy of Ernst and the largest city within the Duchy of Ernst. There's the mention of the playful giant otters. And that is interesting to me because it would speak to me that, you know, the giant otters, I'm not quite sure how big they are from the 1E.
Greater than 7 foot. They're a large creature.
And yet, they are tame enough and at ease enough to come up to the barge folk, which would say to me that they've had contact with them before and never been hunted down or... That's very good. Yeah, the armor class 5. They're reasonably powerful creatures in a pair of them. But again, nothing that caused the Rene any concern. So I would think that they're semi-intelligent. I would think that they have dealt with them before. And there's mention even in their description here that the otters might overturn a small craft. What's very interesting is the pelt of a giant otter, according to the monster manual, sells from between 1,000 to 4,000 gold pieces.
They just passed that up.
And I would say that it goes, I think that would have to be reduced considerably for this campaign that Gygax is writing about in the book, because if you imagine that Gord, as somebody pretending to be rich and gambling with barons and Arentol back in a Greyhawk, that coming away with 30 gold pieces was a monstrous, you know, it was a staggering amount of money. And here we have these otter pelts supposedly going from 1,000 to 4,000. I think we could probably see that more like they might go from, like, but, you know, even if they were only going from, like, 1 to 4 gold pieces, that would seem like, you know, almost worth taking the risk of hunting them down, since they were able, and there's 3 barges, and they were able to take on that sea serpent. Even if it might have destroyed them, they definitely wounded it, and may even have killed it in that fight just by themselves. That's where, you know, the Gygax books, and I like this lower standard, lower gold standard than we have in the game, because I just think whoever came up with the idea that they're 1,000 to 4,000 gold pieces, that really puts the campaign at such a, I mean, then you would think that they'd be hunted to extinction. You know, I mean, 1,000 to 4,000 gold pieces should be a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah, that supports their tutor for like 4 millennia.
I know, it's just
in this economy, in Gary's economy.
Yeah, well, if you figure that, you know, he's only earning 1 gold piece every 2 years, mm-hmm. you know, that it's ridiculous. Like you said, millennia, you know, hundreds of years worth right. of, for someone who's living in the university district, who might be living very prosper, he might be, the sage might be living very economically, but even Gord and San were only paying 4 copper pieces a month to rent a room, the top floor of that, the Acorns Inn. So this much gold value in just an otter pelt that just, you know, that is just that just strikes me that is a you know, that just doesn't seem even realistic for gold standard campaign that we see from the Player's Handbook, you know, where gold is not buying as much as it obviously does in the Saga book here.
And so, I think in some cases gold equates to experience. So
well originally it does, that if you I mean, and that would put you know, when they got gold, they gained, I believe, an experience point in 1E for every gold coin. And at 1 to 4,000, you know, of course, this is supposed to be a 5/5 hit die creature. And if the normal encounter here is, you know, 2 or more, then, you know, number appearing is 2 to 5. That would be, you know, much more a mid-level. But still, that would be a good deal of experience points for hunting down these giant otters. So I think it really goes to show that the design in 1E, even Gygax, you know, it's funny, Gygax is not using the monetary standard from the 1E, you know, the 1E book, but this is something that is, Greyhawk, even this version of Greyhawk is Gygax's version. And the version that comes out in published material, and I probably all the adventures that are in 2E, and some, you know, even the adventures that were the old tournament adventures, they had tremendous amounts of magic items and gold. So, you know, I think that's really, really worth noting, that how far distant, how much of a separation we get between what Gygax is talking about, which I think works better as a campaign, and then what the game is suggesting. And, you know, always a thing with 1E is that I believe you always had to take what was going on in the game and you had to tailor it to what you wanted as a DM and what your players liked having in the game. And it really does seem that, you know, a lower magic availability and a lower gold economy, that sounds much more interesting to me. And having it where there seems to be an overabundance of gold and perhaps magic items. All right. I am going to restart here. We are on page 106, and it is the final paragraph. Ernst was a place of rolling green hills, at least based on what Gord had seen from the barge as it passed along the shoreline. The city of Lukesh was nestled amidst the surrounding hills, although the section farthest from the port area was built on a low plateau so that it dominated the wide valley around it. People did not look much different from those in Greyhawk, being a mixture of Iridians and Sulis, although they dressed quite oddly. Gord thought the long trousers were inferior to the hose typically worn in his home city, and the plaids and checks that the Ernstmen sported seemed either plain or gaudy, depending on the hues and arrangements. Architecture was strange here too, for the buildings all seemed tall and narrow, with pointy arches and square towers. Columns and pillars were everywhere. Roofs were steeply peaked, as were the tower caps. All in all, he could hardly wait to get into the place and find out just how different it was. Like, this is, one of the things that strikes me off the top is that, again, the city of Greyhawk that Gord ends up describing is not flat. And then here in Lukesh, we hear about the older section. The area farthest from the port is built on a low plateau. So again, we have this, most of the maps that I see, and that's becoming a topic of interest, and the show that J. Lord Gazumba is doing with Anna and Alyssa, is that most of the maps that I see for Greyhawk cities are flat. And yet, this is the city of Greyhawk and Lukesh. From Gygax's point of view, they're not. They're a combination of lower areas with maybe fortifications or the original cities built on the high ground. And that's usually the way you would have it in the real world, is that if you were building for defense, you wanted to build on the high ground, which made it more difficult for the walls to be attacked, gave you longer range for missile weapons firing downhill, shorter range for missile weapons trying to fire against gravity uphill. And I find it very interesting that the mapping done for the cities of Greyhawks never really shows any elevations or contours to the map. Now we also get a little description of Ernst's green rolling green hills, again from Gord's limited knowledge, but you could say then that that's what Gord sees. So that's how the shoreline, at least of the Duchy of Ernst, looks, is rolling green hills. We get the business of some description of dress and architecture. The common Greyhawker, the common person that Gord's encountered, is a mixture of Iridian and Sul. No mention of Flan, but Iridian and Sul. And then how the people in Greyhawk wear hose over trousers and plaids and checks, which would be more like in keeping with the plaids and the checks and the trousers. They are very much part of Gaulish culture from the days of, the end of the Roman Republic. That's how the Gauls were, shown to dress in plain or gaudy plaids and checks. And then we have a description of how the buildings are, with tall and narrow, with peaked roofs and capped towers, something you can see in sections of German castles and German buildings. A lot of them had the tower caps. So we get a little more campaign information, and also the idea that the cities are going to be different. They're going to have different styles of dress and different styles of architecture, and something that easily can play into the game for a DM to add character to the people, to the cultures, and to the cities. And Lukesh is not, you know, it is not terribly far. This is their first major port of call up the near Dev. So they're going from the city of Greyhawk to Lukesh and then Radagast City. All right, I'm going to restart here. It's page 107, paragraph 2. Miklos warned him that the Ernstmen were not fond of Rene folk. There had been some trouble in the past, with the Ernstmen claiming that the barge folk practiced piracy, sneak raiding, and worse. Some actual battles had been fought. The whole thing had sort of blown over during the past year. The Duke had troubles elsewhere, and the Rene had no wish to try conducting a war with the duchy. Gord was instructed that, whatever the circumstances, he should be careful, cautious, and polite during his stay in this territory. He mustn't be caught stealing. Kidnapping was forbidden. Seduction was frowned upon. Gord asked if there was anything else. "Yes," the barge folk captain replied. "Give me those silver nobles you extorted from the foolish young fellow who relieved you of Estrella." "But why?" Gord demanded. "Why should I? The cash is mine." "I'm your family lord," Miklos countered. "Besides, I have no money of my own." "How could you be penniless?" Gord was truly at a loss. Miklos stared at the deck. "All the money your family owned was lost betting on Zoltan," he confessed. Right. Well, here we have, a little idea of some of the encounters. It's interesting to know that the people in the duchy do look fondly upon the Rene. But it's also, I think that the context probably implies that the Rene do practice piracy, sneak raiding, and worse, and that that you mustn't be caught stealing and kidnapping, which kind of goes to, I think, what the Rene probably do, that they are a kind of culturally very known as thieves, and I would imagine that as being waterborne, they're probably pirates and raiders when the opportunity presents itself. The old Vikings, they were merchants and raiders, and they would do things like they'd come down the coast and raid, gather up slaves, and take them and sell them lower down the coast as they, sailed down the European coast in the west. And so they would go for raiders of opportunity, but they would also go further down to trade and, bring back goods and items that they didn't normally have for themselves. So here we have the Rene, I think in a more subtle way, perhaps, being the same, thieves and kidnappers and probably opportunistic pirates and raiders. And then we have the little bit of humor here where Miklos didn't believe that Gord was going to win, so he actually bet against him. And now Gord is seemingly, since he's adopted into Miklos' Rene family, he seemingly has to share his coins, or at least Miklos wants to make him believe that, and that he's going to have to turn it over, at least what they know that he has, have to turn it over to Miklos and his family there.
I think I remember the fact that they, like when they had that duel, when he had the duel with Zoltan, I think I remembered that the Rene family, Miklos, etc., did wager against them. I wasn't sure, and I didn't want to say anything, but I remember that.
I remember the wagering. I think this might be the surprise that they did bet against him. The other thing that I would say is that, although it talks about earlier that the barges had left and new barges had come, and yet Zoltan was still there. But Zoltan is obviously not part of on that boat, on the barge with Miklos's barge. So it really makes you that they, a family group of Rene is barges, you know, one barge, one Rene Lord. So I think it's pretty clear that Zoltan and Estrella, neither were part of the Miklos family. And I found it a little strange that Zoltan would still be there after the other barges had left and the new barges had come in. All right, I am going to restart. Oh, well, before I do, I just want to say, here again, we have, if you're running a Duchy of Ernst campaign, or if you're running a Rene campaign, or you just want to have that as a side, then here is a huge amount of ideas that you can have the Rene accused falsely or truthfully accused of kidnapping or thievery. We could have open warfare going on when your campaign is going between ships and guardsmen of the Duchy and the Rene. So there's a lot of activity and action that is going on that you can add to a campaign or adventures around it. And that's something I myself had thought of doing, was doing a, you know, a Rene campaign where you're either an adopted member or you're simply, it seems like you get quite a few kind of character classes. You could have, say, a young female witch. You could have, you know, Rene warriors, Rene thieves, you know, and so you could really cover the essential adventuring classes and have an entirely Rene campaign going on. And this book adds so much more ideas and detail to what we know about the Rene than anything I can really think of in the setting material.
That's a pretty good idea, because in the course of that, with all the characters and the character classes, you could also get to see Greyhawk with a good reason. I mean, sailing around the lake or just traveling. I mean, it would be a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and one thing I want to comment, too, is that you notice, of course, they don't talk. Greyhawk in the book is the city. You know, this might be the Greyhawk campaign, but I think anywhere we hear them talk about Greyhawk, it always refers back to the city of Greyhawk. But yeah, that would be, you know, very, I think, that'd be a very interesting all-Rene campaign to start off with, say, even just a lost barge or a group of young Rene who get away from their family to go out and do some adventuring. Because obviously the Rene, they are much more active and they encounter much more dangers than, say, somebody living in the city of Greyhawk. Say you live in the craft, you're from the craftsman, you may not really encounter much worse than a mugger or a pickpocket or a con game. Whereas obviously there's you know, actual combat going on, and that the Rene are right out there. They're right, they're right out there in the wild. They're going up these various rivers, and that you know, there's danger all around, which is always the sense that I've received, that other than you know, select areas, that the Flaness was a fairly dangerous place. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 107, final paragraph. The gate guards eyed Gord most suspiciously, asked him a couple of questions in oddly stilted common, and then allowed him to pass into Lukesh. The city was bustling with activity, and Gord simply drifted with the traffic, studying everything he saw. Soon he arrived in a rectangular marketplace filled with carts and booths. His practiced eye noticed that there were no discernible thieves loitering about, although some may have been working. Of that he could not be sure. The people here were mostly Ernstmen, with a smattering of outlanders and demi-humans. The goods were typical of such a fair, ranging from all manner of foodstuffs to clothing and household goods. Knowing that the interesting items would be at the far end near the largest buildings, Bard went in that direction. Sure enough, there were the metalsmiths. After After spending a considerable amount of time examining various dirks and daggers, Gord was quite disappointed. Weapons were finely wrought. They just weren't equal to the blade he had lost during the battle with the sea monster. The grizzled seller of weapons at the last stall noted Gord's intensity in examining the poignards, did his best to help by extolling the virtues of each dagger, and then ceased the sales pitch with the following advice. "You seem, sir, a connoisseur of such blades. These are all excellent dags, but what you seek is not here. I suggest you go to the shop of Hangel. If you can meet his price, you will have your weapon." "Where is this Hangel's establishment?" asked Gord. Following the directions of the fellow soon brought Gord to the narrow way leading to a close, as it was described to him. There Gord saw a busy smith and a shop beside it. The forge was working arrowheads, so he passed immediately into the store. A gnarled old dwarf, of great size for one of his sort, was there polishing weapons with an oily cloth. "Good dag," he said to Gord, "how to serve a Aniclad, stranger from Vild Coast." "Greyhawk, actually. I'm here for a dagger." "Ah, sure," the dwarf exclaimed enthusiastically. "Big, little, long, short, narrow, broad, and more. We got them all. Vich." To simplify the process, Gord launched into a detailed description of his lost dagger. He carefully explained its size, shape, decoration, and balance. When he completed the exposition, the dwarf asked some additional details that surprised Gord, for the fellow was accurate in the suggested conformation and decoration of the weapon. "Und now der Weppen is." Gord recounted the tale of the sea serpent's attack and defeat. At the point where he told about casting his dagger into the monster's eye, the dwarf shook his head sadly. The blade, he informed Gord, was most certainly a magic one, but a weapon designed for demi-humans, not folk such as Gord. Had he only been able to have one for himself, Hangel said, Gord could have had his pick of the other magic daggers in his place. "And what?" Gord inquired. "Oh," said the dwarf sadly, "the Longtooth Von Yu was telling about." Never having heard of a Longtooth one before, Gord found it hard to share the dwarf's sense of sadness, although he keenly regretted losing the dagger and was excited at the prospect of replacing it. "I'll show what I do have," Hangel said. Then he paused in his rush toward the cabinet. "To pay mit gold, or is der deal to be a trade?" He eyed Gord's clothing suspiciously as he asked these questions. Without thinking, Gord reached into his sash and drew out the leather bag in which he kept his wealth. His whole attention was so caught by the weapons that he actually shook the bag's contents out onto the counter. The dwarf's eyes fell greedily upon the outpouring, a small pile of platinum and gold, with only a couple of electrum and silver pieces intermixed. Atop all was the cat's eye ring. "So," Hangel could hardly tear his gaze from the metal. "You have much wealth for one so young." He finally managed to look up at Gord, avarice filling his eyes with brightness. "Now I show you all." Too late to rectify his mistake, Gord thought. What a fool to display the contents of one's purse to anyone, let alone a dwarf. There was no help for it now. They must be ready for anything. Hangel had the cabinet open and was hastily rummaging around inside it. He turned, arms loaded with parcels wrapped in velvet. He placed all of them on the counter near Gord's heap of coins, unwrapping each of them quickly but carefully. There were 5 daggers there, each beautifully fashioned, each in its own sheath. "You choose which you want," the dwarf said. "I tell you how much." Page 110. I'm breaking here because page 110 shows a picture of Hengel, and we see the large poignard and the small pile of coins. Hengel's patched cloak on him, and but what we get in this these paragraphs, it really does it's a very key thing to the idea of the Greyhawk campaign. In some settings, they have shops full of magic weapons. Now here, we have Gord in possession of what was a long-toothed dagger, which is, you know, a mentioned type of magical weapon that Gord was completely unaware of. And I believe this was the dagger he got from Ladadov, who had been one of the assistant guildmaster of thieves back in the city of Greyhawk.
When they subdued him in the alley.
Yes, and he had this long poignard, and it turns out it was a magical weapon. Now, here we have
Was he demi-human?
No, he was not. There was no mention, but it really seemed to me that the description would have mentioned if he had been demi-human.
Yeah, I think so, because I don't remember it at all.
And that Ladadov, I'm pretty sure he was just human, as were most of the people encountered in the city of Greyhawk, with a few exceptions here and there.
Like the tall buildings.
Yes. Now, you know, we have, there's quite a bit, few bits, pieces of things here that obviously this is maybe one of the best weapon shops in Lukesh. And here all he has, well, he's showing him daggers, so maybe he has other weapons, but he only has five magic daggers.
Well, five magic daggers that a human could use.
That's right, too. Yes, that is right, that they're not demi-human weapons. So there may be more here, but they are kept away as something special. Now, Gord has pulled out a veritable fortune. You know, with platinum coins and gold coins, and like we said, you know, this would be an absolute fortune in the city of Greyhawk, and here in Lukesh, which is a much smaller city. It normally, you know, the big city should be where the metals are worth the least. But here we have, I like it that the dwarf seems to be German here. Mm-hmm. You know, either that or Norwegian, or you know, kind of Norse-like, even the, you know, with the language and the accent that they're projecting. We have we've got a nice little description of wandering through Lukesh here. We notice that even the guards, they speak common, but it's with an odd accent. We have that the common weapons that are available in the regular part of the marketplace, that it has there don't seem to be available magic weapons there. We have the rectangular, the city is bustling. We have a rectangular marketplace that has the carts and the booths and I guess the shops. We have the here that the people are Ernstmen, which I would assume are humans, and a smattering of outlanders and demi-humans. In the Lukesh, as he's describing it, at least the section of the city he's in, there might be demi-humans, but they are only a smattering compared to the human population. We learned that, you know, that there are weapons that are based magic weapons designed for demi-humans, and that's always something that I've seen this hand wave quite a bit in adventures where the adventurers discover they're someplace and they discover this magic armor or these weapons, and they're just immediately everything is like human-sized. Where you should be able to discover like if you're in a place where there are goblins and they've got armor, then none of that armor should be for a human. And even many demi-humans wouldn't be able to wear that kind of armor. And now to have the idea that you also should be splitting up the idea that there should be racial characteristics to normal magic items, so that like a dwarven axe or an elven longbow or an, you know, that there should be, they should work better in the hands of the people who created them. And I really like that. I really think that enriches the campaign, so that everything isn't so generalized and immediately beneficial without question to the players. I think it'd be very interesting for them to discover these weapons and armor and devices that are magical, but they can't use them, or they can't use them properly. And maybe one of their post-adventuring goals would be that they'd have to go and trade in this stuff so they could get more useful things. And exactly. maybe it would require them to discover like dwarven armor and dwarven weapons, and have to track down some area where there are enough dwarves, an enclave or, you know, a country, have to make a trip to be able to really get their worth out of the value of those items. Because you can imagine like the halflings who are so small, what are you going to find that's going to fit them? You know, if we get back to Lord of the Rings, the armor that Bilbo and Frodo have, the mithril shirt, that was designed for a young child, an elven prince, young elven prince, who was so small that he was the size of a halfling or a hobbit. And I really like the idea that you would be looking for weapons that that certain weapons would be good for humans, but not as good for elves or dwarves or halflings or gnomes or monsters. And that once you've gotten them into the, and I would say, you know, you'd probably have people like sages who you could find to, if they couldn't identify the magic, they could probably identify the markings. Because right here, Hangel, he is by description of the dagger, the poignard, he is able to guess that what kind of magical weapon it was. And a demi-human long-toothed dagger. And that, you know, I think that is, you know, very, very, you know, I think that's a great little thing to add to the idea of the campaign. And right here we also have, again, the ring, the cat's eye ring, makes its appearance once more right here.
Yeah, the crystal barrel ring.
Yeah, crystal barrel. I'm not sure. I guess that's a real description. I haven't heard of that before, but I'm not really any kind of expert in gems or anything. So,
not like Hangel.
Not like Hangel, no. And obviously, and I am interested that Gord is so distracted by this. It's uncharacteristic that Gord just, you know, reaches for his coin purse and just pours out everything. Because Gord, while seemingly a little naive with women, seems to be very good about coin. So I find it unexpected. And, you know, perhaps imagine how handy it would be for these merchants to have, say, Hangel dealing with magic items. Maybe, cool.
Yeah, it is a real thing.
Maybe he has a magical device or item that makes people, you know, a little freer with their money. You know, just something that will, you know, that they'll do like Gord. Well, they'll pull out their coin purse and, you know, I mean, that is just striking that Gord, you know, just pours all, because he's, you know, he's very much known for, and again, with the disguise and the subtlety, you know, that here we have again, that this is kind of the opposite of that, where Gord is suddenly very unsubtle, and just showing immediately what he has, which is terrible bargaining technique, from the point where the beginning of the story, Gord the orphan is hiding his coins like Lena did, and had hidden her coins in her cloth. Gord had hidden his in his cape. And here, the much more experienced Gord just pours his coins out onto the counter. And it makes me think that maybe there's something a little more magical or subtle going on right here that would have Gord do that. Even over the excitement of getting back and hearing that he had a magical dagger, but that he's going to be able to buy one. And in this campaign, there are so few mentions of magical items that such a thing should be an expensive item.
Yeah, Henkel seems a little caught up in that avarice too, though. When he sees the coins, he's thrown off his game, just like Gord's thrown off his game when he sees the weapons.
Yes, and it's mentioned again that that is a dwarven characteristic, a very not just a Tolkienism, but a Norse idea of greed. There were in Norse mythology, there were the dwarves, like the Ring of Nibelungen, that there were the dwarves who became dragons because of their love of wealth. Well, we're at 7 o'clock. I'm going to stop here and end it for the night. And this was recording number 14 of the Saga Old City. Now, we have the archives set up on Canonfire, and you can find links to them. And you can read, I believe, that already the previous 13 recordings are up. And if you are listening and want to listen to the live, very much welcome to come and participate, or with your voice, or we have the Greyhawk Fiction text channel. And if you want to ask questions or not be on the recordings, please feel free, come in. And down the road, hopefully, we'll also have some text channels on the Greyhawk website so that you can add your own questions and comments to the previous recordings. Well, thank you all. Thanks, Chris, and good night to everybody. All right.